Uncle Don here with the 297th opening of the Porcupine Petting Zoo, my first for the brave new year of 2009. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM at UNBC in Prince George. George Bush has prepared his final goodbye kisses to Washington and the world stage. Sabotage of his successor is huge compared with what his followers wrongly claimed had been done by President Clinton's departing crew. They said that White House computers had all had their W keys removed. That was the first of 8 years of straight lies. Compare this accusation with the poison chalice being handed to President Obama. A storm of regulation changes have been proclaimed, gifts to corporations, the rich, and industrial polluters. These will be effective before Obama's taking office and could take years to reverse. George bequeaths a legacy of $10 trillion in new public debt and government obligations. To put this in perspective, $10 trillion is roughly the number of cells in the human body. George leaves American soldiers tied down in two unjustified overseas invasions and occupations, draining untold wealth while destroying American credibility worldwide. America, beneficiary of a huge international reservoir of sympathy in the wake of the 2001 creation of the World Trade Crater, is now feared and hated. George's refusal to enforce laws of the land, best exhibited by his more than 1,000 signing statements attached to laws passed by Congress, paved the way for corporate lawlessness. He underfunded regulatory agencies, staffing them with right-wing stooges, emasculating the federal government and its relations with corporations. George's carrying on with deregulation begun in the era of Reagan and Thatcher has found its natural end with the collapse of bloated credit markets. George resurrected the practice of torture, a horror we thought that civilized nations had left behind. Yes, I guess they did, as George deliberately removed the all-powerful United States from the ranks of civilized nations. And now, to top off George's other high crimes and misdemeanors, we have his connivance with Israel in its invasion of Gaza. I haven't the slightest doubt that Israel chose this time for its attack, knowing that it has the full support of the dying Bush regime. For them, Obama is an unknown factor, while Bush is firmly in their pocket. They're striking before arrival of the incoming administration, which might not be so subservient. Unstinting American support for Israel is no secret, with $30 billion in direct aid given in the last decade and an unknown amount of military support. Palestinian victims of this current attack are exhibiting fragments of bombs bearing the phrase, "Made in USA." Bring on the war crimes trials. Will this be a year of great and good changes? The world expects wondrous things of the Obama administration, and we're bound to be disappointed on many fronts. The presidency is in office with a capability of unlimited destruction, but only slow incremental construction. Bush neocons have made such a mess of the United States and its government that it will take more than one or two terms to sort it all out. Wars against Afghanistan and Iraq will continue, although tactics may change. Israel may be reined in a bit, but this will not bring back the hundreds murders in their latest attack against Palestine, nor will they tear down their obscene walls stealing Palestinian lands. They'll continue to fuel hatred in the Middle East that will not die for generations, if ever. Cash will still be shoveled out of treasuries to the very firms that caused the financial collapse, and dinosaur industries will demand more and more public money. I dread the changes coming in 2009 as flocks of chickens come home to roost. The status quo ante is not an option. We have a few precedents to guide us, but stability is unlikely. Either economic contraction will bring deflation, or massive increases in money supply and debt will bring inflation. I can't see an achievable balance between the two. What to do in the new year? Keep clear of military recruiters, stop buying junk, and pay off your debts. I know that the macroeconomy calls for personal spending as a boost, but individual microeconomics demands that we retrench. This is a contradiction we have to deal with, but the smart person knows that he or she needs to take care of number one first, and we can't cure the crisis by individual actions. When the going gets tough, the tough change the rules. Like when oil companies have to report huge cuts in the value of their inventories based on current prices, accounting rules are changed to allow them to use a fabricated 12-month average that melds today's prices with the highs of $147 per barrel. Very cute. and General Motors Acceptance Corporation, the GM arm financing both dealers and buyers of their cars, pulled some accounting stunts, emerging as a virtual bank. This was, of course, to slip this entity into the line of supplicants eligible for a piece of the $700 billion-plus U.S. Treasury funds shoveled out the door to banks. GMAC got a few billion, allowing them to loosen retail lending standards and move the metal off lots into North American driveways. Now, let me get this straight. The United States and the world are suffering from the effects of a subprime mortgage fiasco in which loans were made to individuals who could not expect to maintain payments. Some of these were for 100% of the inflated home values with teaser interest rates. General Motors is being bailed out by Canadian and United States taxpayers who've granted billions to its financing arm. GMAC is using that money to lend to potential buyers who have lower credit ratings while renewing 0% at lending on some of their vehicles. So we're morphing a subprime housing debacle to a potential subprime vehicle debacle. Lower creditworthiness coupled with loosening terms is a recipe for moving the crisis, not curing it. When these new buyers of GM's dinosaurs default in the face of job losses, lower incomes, or rising gas prices, who will again be called upon to bail out the automakers when all these repossessed vehicles hit the used car market at bargain prices? Two guesses. Jim Flaherty, Canada's Minister of Finance, said the current crisis should not be wasted. This attitude is eerily reminiscent of the theme of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. Ambitious players grab power and assets when a perceived crisis makes citizens panic and demand drastic action. The result is always a decrease in popular power, rights, and well-being. This financial meltdown sees the rich and powerful, largely corporations, being handed the keys to treasuries around the planet. Suddenly, every business seems too big to fail as bailouts spread from banks to autos to forestry and beyond. This takes care of the corporate side, but what about the poor speculator who may have seen his dubious investments deteriorate in resale value? We must do something for this suffering parasite. Behind the facade of multitudes of rescues is a push to slip in a change in tax policies long favored by self-styled conservatives. This is the proposed cut in capital gains taxes. Such would have little stimulus effect when most assets are losing, not gaining in monetary value, but it would be a welcome gift for those who buy at the bottom and profit from a coming bounce. If some poor millionaire buys real estate, stocks, or other assets and later sells them, unimproved, at a higher price, why should he have to pay tax on his unearned profit? It's not like he dirtied his hands with real work. He's just played a speculative game, winning money. It should be treated like lottery winnings, according to conservatives. Let the gamblers keep their winnings without government taking a cut. Meanwhile, of course, those who do actual work must make up lost revenue with higher wage taxes on wages. Let's suck more from them in deductions for income taxes and tack on a bit for unemployment insurance, the benefits of which most will never be eligible to collect. Tom DeKino, mouthpiece for chief executive officers of the largest corporations operating in this country, has proposed the formula for recovery. We must improve competitiveness. This will be accomplished by reducing business taxes, eliminating regulations, dropping capital gains taxes, and rebuilding infrastructure that corporations use, at public expense, of course. Hit the suckers and reward the parasites. Isn't that the formula Canada needs for recovery? And recovery for whom? Civilized nations recoil at the barbarity of Israel's bombing of Gaza, their merciless shelling of infrastructure in that huge open-air prison which is Gaza mirrors the Bush regime's invasion of Afghanistan in that it is a response to criminal acts, in this case the random launching of homemade rockets into Israel, by making war on a quasi-nation state. Whatever the rationale for this huge asymmetrical response, with body counts of Palestinians to Israelis running 100-1, the timing is obvious. This bombing was to catch the last days of the dying Bush regime, knowing that the great decider is a tame supporter of anything done by Israel. No crime of Israel is great enough to erode support for that nation with arms, money, and the all-powerful American veto in the Security Council. Israel sees its biggest threat not in Osama, but in Obama, who may not give unstinting support to their Zionist state to which it has become accustomed over the last half century. A Jewish friend lamented that North America made a critical mistake by not taking in all Jewish refugees around the time of World War II, while stifling the fanatical Zionist quest to steal the bulk of Palestine. We could have used the Jews' drives and talent while sparing ourselves generations of conflict in the Middle East. Even now may not be too late. We could accept the implicit advice of one official of the Fraser Institute who told me, face to face, that there is room in Texas to accommodate all the people on earth without strain. If this Fraser Institute still holds this ridiculous notion, surely they could support the bulk transport of all Israelis to the Lone Star State, leaving the Palestinians to sort out their own problems. My favorite carpet-bagging retail chain, Malwart, will be paying as much as 640 million Yankee dollars to settle some 63 federal and state class action suits alleging that this multi-billion dollar monster felt compelled to screw its multitudes of workers out of mandatory work breaks. Nice going, Waltons. I guess this little bit of extortion from your underpaid non-union employees added to your grossly inflated fortunes. This hit on their profits amounts to less than 0.1% of their third of $1 trillion in revenue last year. When does one family have enough billions that it can afford to be generous to the employees who earned them that fortune with their sweated labor? And haven't we seen in the last year that unrestrained greed leads to ruin? I would hope that the Waltons one day, soon, may have an Ebenezer Scrooge-style enlightenment, but I doubt it. Happy New Year, you greedy buggers. According to a member of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, one of Obama's first tasks in office will be deciding how to deal with the Iranian threat. Yes, threat. And what is this terrible threat that must take precedence over other massive problems, domestic and foreign? It is that Iran insists on exercising its right, as formalized in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to refine uranium for peaceful purposes. International inspectors affirm that there are no signs of Iran's refining U-235 to a purity necessary for nuclear weapons, so what's the problem? The problem, as laid out by the Bush regime, is that Iran is a rogue state, threatening the survival of their peaceful neighbors, like, for instance, Israel. Poor beleaguered Israel, home to some 200 or so nuclear bombs, a fact officially denied, is threatened by nasty old Iran, whose creaking infrastructure can't even produce the gasoline its economy needs, and whose youth suffer massive unemployment. Peaceful Israel operates the world's largest prison camp, the Land of Gaza, one chunk of Palestine that is not fully colonized. As I speak, Gaza is being bombed, ostensibly because some homemade rockets fired into Israel by those who seem to believe they have a right not to be tormented in the remaining fragment of their own land. And Gazans seem to resent the fact that their airspace, sea coast, and land borders are sealed by Israel. I admit that I cannot get carried away by fear of Iran. Greater is my fear of Israel and its faithful apologists in the United States. While discussing militarism, it brings to mind my experience as a soldier, a 38-month phase of my life beginning 50 years ago next month. My army still had a few veterans of World War II and quite a number from the Korean mess. Our infantry weapon was the M1 rifle, a heavy, durable, semi-automatic machine that still took a bayonet. Looking at photos of today's troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, I recognize little of the equipment they bear. And it isn't just the gear that's unfamiliar to me. My fellow soldiers were a mixed bag of draftees and those who volunteered for reasons of their own. Few that I met were outstanding. We were mostly confused kids and young adults, mostly single or on our way to becoming so, as marriages between young men posted overseas and women left at home with a pitiful stipend were perishable. Those, like me, in technical service jobs suffered arbitrary military discipline and boring routine jobs. If news reports of Canada's casualties represent a fair sampling of our men and women in uniform, the human fodder of the war machine is much different from the American one of half-century past. Today's Canadian soldiers are heads of families with children, beloved of all. They are leaders of their communities, known for a good sense of humor and admired by peers. I know this from reading obituaries of the 100-plus who've died in Afghanistan. I'm faced with a choice here. Either Canada's armed forces are drawn from a very different pool of talent than was in the U.S. Army of my era, or I'm being bullshitted. If obituaries are strongly larded with malarkey, the government's following suit with the rest of the lies we're routinely fed. If they're all true, we're wasting fine talent on the battlefield that is in short supply in civilian society and our labor force. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. 14 years ago, mid-December, my mother phoned me to say that she had been diagnosed with terminal cancer and was given just weeks, if not days, to live. I booked off work with a supervisor who had defied the Peter Principle by rising not one, but two steps beyond her level of competence, and flew south to western North Carolina. Sorry if the directions confuse you. My brother and I spent most of the days until Mother's death on Christmas Day, 1994, visiting her in her hospice. After her death, I returned to find that in my absence, I was used by the administration to make some drastic changes to my job and that they dare not do in my presence. Creative parts had been excised, leaving me with routine drudgery. I was upset. I had only been working for a week or so when I found that one of my directors had made promises to my clients without informing me. Fulfilling these promises had been left to me. On Friday, the 6th of January, 1995, I faced scores of angry men demanding the fruits of those promises, which I could not supply. That evening, I was so mad I was steaming. I ranted to my unfortunate wife, my sole audience, that I now hated my job. She begged me to quit. We sat down and did a back-of-the-envelope calculation of our financial prospects if I and we were not working. We were both eligible for early retirement pensions and would soon be able to collect the Canada pension and perhaps American Social Security. Add to this an inheritance from my mother's estate, and we could make it. On Monday, the 9th of January, I arrived at work early, awaiting my inept supervisor. She came in the office and said, "Good morning." I replied that she didn't know how good it was, handed her my identification, and informed her I was retiring forthwith. She looked stunned and could only say, but, as I walked out. My first stop was the personnel office, where I filed the necessary papers, and I was free and unemployed. The next day, I began auditing two courses in international studies and political science at UNBC. 2 months later, my wife followed me into retirement, and we've never looked back. Neither of us had realized the constant stress we experienced at work until a couple of weeks after leaving, when it felt as though a weight had been lifted from our shoulders. Back in those salad days, the talk among workers was of Freedom 55. What a difference a decade makes. Now it looks like many of today's employees will have to work until they drop in their traces. This illustrates the wisdom of not only choosing your parents carefully, but also the year of your birth. While working at that last job, I was sometimes quite confused by talk in the lunchroom. One day, a person was talking about how you'd be able to retire in a few years with a decent pension. A few days later, the same person announced the purchase of a new house. When I asked the terms of the mortgage, the answer was 25 years. How would he pay down a loan when monthly payments would be a hefty percentage of his pension? No answer. The early retirement was a dream. In the intervening years, I've met many of the people who I knew who planned retirement while carrying large debts. I see them at the airport where they work onerous hours for less than half their previous salaries. In effect, they're not working for the airport authority. They're working for banks and finance companies. There, but for the grace of the gods and a schooling in finance at my father's knee, go I. My parents struggled through the last depression with little money. They experienced a world war when there was adequate money, but goods were either unavailable or rationed. They taught me a lesson also learned by my wife, whose parents survived the same periods. Always live within your income and save something, no matter how little, from every paycheck. Both sets of parents had a similar attitude toward debt. Except in cases of extreme emergency, you only borrow for expensive assets that pay for themselves or are necessary for earning a living. In those days, one could only buy a house with a hefty down payment. Even then, one would balance the price of rent against a home mortgage and cost of maintenance. There was no compelling pressure to own a house, and a car was bought when one could pay cash. An exception would be if it was necessary for work, and even then a used vehicle would be first choice. I naively assumed that everyone shared my deep-seated evaluation of debt, that it was something entered into with trepidation, and that a major goal was to pay it off. My eyes were recently opened in talking with some young people who were in deep debt several times their annual earnings. Suddenly I realized that their goal was not to pay down that debt. They expect to live with debt forever, not eliminate it, but to manage it. That, in my estimation, is a gross misreading of the situation. You don't manage debt, it manages you. As long as you owe a dollar, the dollar in your pocket is not yours. It belongs to your creditor, and if you choose not to repay it immediately, you pay rent on it in the form of interest. The person in debt is tied to his job, and that's just what the capitalist system wants. One with savings and no debt has a cushion to carry over between an onerous dead-end job and one with better pay or prospects. The employee who is two paychecks away from homelessness is stuck. I'm amazed by the number of people I know in middle or late life who are still paying for a car they purchased at 16. They never fully paid for that car, always using one as the down payment for the next and paying interest to corporate Shylocks for all their adult lives. I'm severely out of step with my peers. I bought my first car, a new Volkswagen, for $2,000 in cash at the tender age of 28. My first house, the one I own jointly with my wife, was purchased with 50% down when I was 50 years old. We had some family help with that half, but a good part of it was savings. We scrimped and saved until we could pay off that mortgage quick time, and we've been debt-free ever since. If we'd been carrying a large debt on a large house in Mortgage Heights with toys in the garage, could I have kissed my job goodbye as I did? Might I still be grinding away daily, biting my tongue while suffering the supervision of idiots? Maybe. Many people are doing just that. I always suspected that the house of cards being built with easy loans and those damn credit cards would come to haunt society. I am now vindicated. I regret that it's very difficult to avoid acquiring a credit card. Try renting a car or making a hotel reservation without one. My brother had an extreme experience with his introduction to credit cards. In the 1980s, he ran a lucrative version of Liquidation World from our mother's basement in North Carolina. He bought distressed and gray market goods from hither and yon, selling them in flea markets and, more importantly, trucking them to New York where they were worth more. All of his business was straight cash. One time, when visiting down there, I watched my brother extricate a full $33,000 from various pockets and body stashes. Any number of times he rented a truck for a one-way trip north, never having any hassles. Then the rental company demanded a credit card for a vehicle. They would not sway. He offered to give them a cash deposit for the full value of the truck, and still they would not budge. In desperation, he turned to his bank, applying for a credit card. His application was refused, as he could not provide evidence of a job. The kicker was that he had $200,000 deposited in that same bank. His reaction was a thing to behold. He arose in high righteous indignation at the injustice of a system wherein a pubescent kid with a part-time minimum-wage job could obtain a credit card while he, with hundreds of thousands of dollars in deposits, could not acquire one with a lousy $500 limit. Eventually, he inveigled a card and the furor died down. As far as I know, he never charged anything on it, but he needed to flash it nonetheless. Until recently, I feared that climate change, as fostered by our extravagant lifestyles and profligate use of natural resources, might make the planet unfit for our species. I've been informed that there is a phenomenon equally threatening to continuation of the human race. That is the dreaded homosexuality. It must be true, as the Pope of Rome has so declared it, perhaps in an aptly named papal bull. I don't know for sure. You see, according to prophecy, our species depends on a strict dividing line between male and female. When we confuse the two, we lay the foundation of our own doom. I guess that means that I have to continue to split the wood while my wife does the cooking, or we are sabotaging God's whole six-day do-it-yourself job. This warning applies only to the minority Christian sect, of course, as other cultures have been less, shall I say, anal retentive on manners sexual. Take the Hindus of India, for instance, where there is a caste called the Hijras, the subject of a text in UNBC's introductory women's studies course entitled Neither Man Nor Woman. Hindus are not so uptight over bicameral distinctions and can tolerate ambiguity. It's part of Western culture to divide things strictly into one class or another. We categorize biological kingdoms as either animal or vegetable and get all out of sorts when finding a cross between the two. Politically, we are taken to be either right or left. The economy expands or contracts, and there's panic when one like Japan's achieves an equilibrium. And so it is, especially in certain religious circles, with male and female. Biologists and psychologists know that we all exhibit traits of both sexes, and we all have estrogen and androgen flowing in our blood. But of course, this is just science, and scientists haven't the insight bequeathed by an ancient book written by men who believed the earth to be flat. On the 22nd of December, a dam broke in Kingston, Tennessee, flooding the land and Tennessee River with upwards of 4 billion liters of toxic coal ash stored in holding ponds belonging to the Tennessee Valley Authority. Beside flowing to the river, this waste covered 160 hectares of land up to 2 meters deep. The Tennessee River is a source of drinking water to that state, as well as residents of Alabama and Kentucky. This slurry spilled contains mercury, heavy metals like lead and arsenic, and other toxic and radioactive chemicals. The TVA has advised those using river water to boil it before drinking, but this is a palliative that will not limit the effects of the poisons. Naturally, officials were immediately trotted out to declare there's no danger to the public. Initial reaction to disasters always seems to be the same: no need to panic. Dead fish can be seen on the riverbanks, and those drinking the water have been known to vomit repeatedly, but this is no cause for alarm. Few Canadians drink from the Tennessee River, so we're complacent regarding these news reports. Such a thing could never happen in pristine, environmentally conscious Canada. Well, maybe not. Around Fort McMurray, there's a geological formation you may have heard of called the tar sands by most and oil sands by corporate apologists. These are being mined, and in the process, a certain amount of contaminated waste is generated. This waste is sent to holding ponds, which are actually huge man-made lakes, large enough to be visible from space. These lakes are contained by massive dikes, some of the largest engineering constructions ever built. The dikes leak, although companies claim the leakage is minuscule, no more than 1 million liters a day. And of course, they're harmless in spite of what the natives in Fort Chippewan may claim as they whine about high rates of cancer and such. When, not if, one or more of these earthen dams breaks, toxic sludge in many billions of liters will flood into the Athabasca River, causing destruction all the way through the Mackenzie River Basin to the Beaufort Sea and the fragile waters of the Arctic Ocean. All in the name of feeding America's voracious appetite for petroleum. Canada has willingly allowed this destructive time bomb to be built in the heart of our nation. Shame on us. This has been the 297th uplifting edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Sweet dreams.